Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
A quick warning before we jump in. This episode is about one of the most notorious serial killers in history and thus has some upsetting and graphic content. Please don't be like the woman who complained that the musical Six should have come with a trigger warning. When a story has been told so many times that it has become a part of the fabric of history, how do we untangle the details and look deeper? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. Recently, on a trip to London, I learned about the Crossbones Graveyard, which was a mass burial pit rediscovered in the 90s. While more than half the bodies buried in the forgotten pit were children, it's believed that most of the adult bodies found belonged to women who'd been forced into sex work because of their lack of access to education and income. According to the website Living London History, quote, "Their life expectancy would have been pretty dreadful, with disease and violence being very common." This is where Crossbones comes in. Due to their sinful profession, they were excluded from Christian burial, and so were interred in the unconsecrated burial ground at Crossbones, known then as St. Saviour's Burial Ground. It became a graveyard for all those who were deemed unworthy of a decent burial or simply could not afford it, the forgotten and the outcast, end quote. The victims in today's story were also treated with this kind of disregard for more than a century. Indeed, their suspected murderer has received more thought, attention, and consideration than they ever did. To this day, Jack the Ripper only has 5 official victims, most of whom were generally not graced with a name when the story has been told. But there were likely others, which makes one wonder, if even his official victims could be so easily forgotten, what does that say about the women who didn't even make it onto the list? There are figures that loom so large in the zeitgeist that it's easy to forget that they were real people who had a real impact on the world. Jack the Ripper is one of those figures. Anytime a woman is found murdered and mutilated, Jack the Ripper is inevitably the first comparison that's made. He is the subject of movies, songs, books, and comic books. Yes, comic books. It's wild how anyone could take one of history's most despicable men and turn him into a comic book character. But our fascination with the macabre knows no bounds, I guess. The problem with turning the man who became known as Jack the Ripper into a larger-than-life legend is that his victims have become an afterthought. Indeed, the women Jack the Ripper murdered in so gruesome a fashion were an afterthought before they had the terrible misfortune of meeting Jack and whatever demons he was carrying around with him. Life in the Whitechapel district of London in the late 19th century was abjectly bad. Whitechapel was what we would call today an economically depressed area that housed the manual laborers of the day whose work, though essential, has never been properly valued. According to author James Greenwood in his 1883 book In Strange Company, the intersection around Flower and Dean Streets was, quote, "perhaps the foulest and most dangerous street in the whole metropolis," end quote. And a piece from the Daily Mail from 1901 named a nearby street, quote, "the worst street in London," end quote. It was a loud, dirty, smelly place to live, and many did so either without a roof over their heads or crammed into overcrowded boarding houses. The overcrowding made living conditions filthy. 2 out of every 10 children didn't live past the age of 5. And of course, where there is extreme poverty, there is usually crime. Because, as my 11-year-old put it the other day, if you treat people so bad for so long, what do you expect them to do? Amen, kid. Anyway, conditions were bad, and as per usual, women bore the main brunt of the awfulness. You see, when you deny women an education or equal opportunity and you make them almost entirely dependent on men, their choices are extremely limited if and when something happens to the men upon which the women are dependent. If a woman's husband died, for example, and she couldn't find a replacement, what was she to do? With no job skills and therefore very few options for making a living, how was she expected to survive? Or if a woman's husband was violent, often her options were to stay and bear the abuse or try to survive on her own. And so, many women who found themselves in the predicament of suddenly having to rely on themselves for a living turned to sex work. And of course, you don't need a degree in criminology to know that sex workers are exponentially more likely to be the victims of violence than their non-sex working peers. In 1888, an alarming number of women in the Whitechapel district fell victim to someone or someones harboring an incredible amount of rage. John Douglas is a criminal personality profiler for the FBI who served on the Bureau's elite serial crime squad, having interviewed, among others, Ted Bundy, Charles Manson, and John Wayne Gacy. He, along with collaborator Mike Olshaker, has penned several true crime books on serial killers and is behind the whole Mindhunter franchise on Netflix. Douglas is a recent and reasoned voice on Ripperology. He said it best when he wrote that Jack the Ripper was and is, quote, the personification of mindless brutality, of nameless, motiveless evil, end quote. And Lord knows I'm no seasoned criminal profiler, but we actually don't know if he had no motive. We don't really know anything at all about him, which makes the whole thing even scarier. And as little as we know about the man, we know even less about his victims. We know so little about them, we're not even certain how many there were. Hell, we can't even say for sure there was only one man butchering women in Whitechapel.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
On February 25, 1888, a 38-year-old widow named Annie Millwood showed up to a local infirmary saying a man attacked her from behind, stabbing her repeatedly in the legs and lower abdomen. She remained hospitalized for a month and was released. But 10 days after being released, she died. Doctors declared the cause of death, oddly enough, to be natural. Her left pulmonary artery had ruptured due to some ulceration. So, a woman went to the hospital with multiple stab wounds and then died because her artery was ruptured. Unrelated to being stabbed. Okay. But Annie isn't one of the so-called canonical 5 women attributed to Jack the Ripper. Then came Ada Wilson, an East End dressmaker who was attacked after answering a knock on the door just after midnight on March 28, 1888. Her assailant was a man who wanted money, which she gave him under threat if she did not. He stabbed her twice in the throat anyway. She lived. She is also not an official victim of Jack the Ripper. In fact, you might remember Ms. Wilson from my episode about Spring-Heeled Jack. She may have been a victim of either Jack, Ripper or Spring-Heeled, though no one has ever been able to say which, if either, actually attacked her. A few days later, Emma Smith, 45, and a widow left to sex work to survive, was out during the evening of April 2, 1888. She left her boarding house early on, then returned about 9 hours later in terrible shape. When she was seen at the London hospital, doctors noted that her ear had almost been torn off, her face was bruised and beaten, and she'd been sexually assaulted with something so forcibly that her perineum was torn. She died at the hospital a few days later. Emma is also not officially considered one of Jack's victims. She reported that she was attacked by three men, though she is considered the first of the so-called Whitechapel murders, which is weird considering Ada Wilson was murdered in Whitechapel before Emma. Not sure why she didn't make the list. Likewise, Martha Tabram, who was found lying in a pool of blood on the steps of a tenement building on August 7th of 1888. She had been precariously posed such that her legs were propped open and her fists clenched. The doctor who'd been called to the scene undressed her to discover she'd been stabbed 39 times, though not likely sexually assaulted. Though, to be honest, I'm not sure I'd place much weight on that finding. I doubt most male doctors would have been able to identify a sexual assault post-mortem. It was determined Martha died from blood loss at the very place where she'd been attacked. She bore no defensive wounds, which made sense as she'd been choked first and with such force that her head and face were so swollen as to be unidentifiable. A local paper held nothing back. The report said the victim had been literally butchered. The killer's virulent savagery had been beyond comprehension. After a week and several misidentifications, the woman's estranged husband came forward to identify her. The couple had two sons, but had not lived jointly for 13 years. Martha, who chose the last name Turner for her street work, occasionally also told people that her last name was Staples or Stapleton. This little quirk of the victims having various names will remain consistent throughout the Ripper story. I'll do my best to keep them all clear. Martha had been hanging out with a woman named Mary Ann Connolly, who went by Pearlie Paul, that night. By the way, Martha was known to Ms. Connolly as Emma Turner. See what I mean here? The two women spent some time that evening with a couple of military boys. Neither man was charged with Martha's murder. Emma Smith and Martha Tabram, as noted by writer Philip Sudgeon in his definitive analysis of the Ripper, had been attacked 100 yards of one another. And yet, in the popular Ripper lore, none of these women is listed as an official Ripper victim. Neither are Rose Milet or Alice McKenzie, and, as you will see, a woman who died 2 years later. She was named Frances Coles. But Emma Smith reported three attackers, and Ada Wilson was robbed and survived her attack, so I can see why they might not have made the official list. But Tabram fits into the Ripper framework, though who knows? Anyway, the first crime to be attributed to the Ripper, and likely the one most documented, occurred with the August 31st, 1888 killing of Mary Ann Nichols, who was known as Polly. She was, like both Miss Smith and Miss Tabram, poor, middle-aged, and often drunk, relying on her body to make enough to eat something hot and sleep somewhere unmolested. Seems that late on that August night, she had tried to find lodging but did not have the fourpence to get a bed. Little info here, a fourpence is around a dollar in today American money. So Marianne, aka Polly, told the guy at the flophouse door to hold a bed for her because she'd be right back with the coin. She also flaunted a spiffy black hat some John had given her or she'd found on the street, and told the proprietor that she'd have little trouble attracting business because of her new chapeau. She was found later with the hat beside her, warm to the touch, but dead, with obvious gaping slashes to her throat. When she was thoroughly examined, it was clear that the neck wounds, while extraordinarily deep, were the least of it. Marianne's abdomen had been split open, with her intestines exposed. The coroner then noted that he believed the killer had wanted to remove her head entirely, but failed. She, like all that followed, was determined not to have been alive when the mutilation began. Neither is there any proof that they had been sexually assaulted. On September 8, 1888, only a week after Mary Ann Nichols was brutalized, and with police still investigating, Annie Chapman lay dead near the entry to a tenement and its outdoor toilet. Her butchered remains are a testament to madness. I don't normally go into gruesome detail, but it seems the details of what was done to Annie is important to spell out. Take a deep breath. Annie's left arm was placed across her left breast, and her legs were drawn up and open. Her throat had been almost cut clean through. her intestines had been cut from within the abdomen and placed over her shoulder. The killer had also removed her uterus, half of her vagina, as if desexing her, and most of her bladder. Those were now missing. 2 feet away from her body was a blood-stained leather apron, the kind worn by slaughterhouse workers or shoemakers, maybe. Arranged around her body were items ostensibly taken from her purse. Medical professionals told police that the killer likely had some rudimentary medical training because of the precision and expertise in removing her organs. This theory persists, its accuracy debated for more than a century. The larger London audience was alerted now, with hundreds of extra cops on the beat doing their best to catch someone in the act, or at least to be a visible presence to dissuade any would-be killers. The area was also teeming with reporters who flocked to Whitechapel to tell stories of what life there was like and what the people there were afraid of now. Much of the reportage was full of coroner's reports and detailed maps of the environs. So, yeah, no gruesome detail escaped readers. And then, nearly 3 weeks later, a letter arrived at the central news agency that read,
"Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me the real fits. I am down on whores and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave that lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work, and I want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue, and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for jolly, wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp. I want to get to work right away if I can get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack. The Ripper. Don't mind me giving the trade name. P.S. Wasn't good enough to post this before I got all the red ink off my hands, curse it. No luck yet. They say I'm a doctor now.
The red stuff, he referenced, in case that wasn't clear, was blood, meaning he claimed to have tried to make ink out of one of his victims' blood. Failing that, he just used red ink. The press ate this up, of course. But while there was plenty of coverage of the murders, little to no information was given about the victims. In 2019, historian and author Haley Rubenhold wrote The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper. In it, she takes the London press at the time to task for their rampant fascination with the case. She writes, quote, "Neither did the editors nor the journalists covering the story deem it necessary, worthy, or interesting to delve into the biographical details of the victims. Ultimately, no one cared about who they were or how they ended up in Whitechapel," end quote. I agree with Rubenhold, but that is not how journalism was done in London in 1888. These were women society had deemed as hopeless and depraved, women who had chosen a life of debauchery because, you know, they had so many other options. Of course, it could be argued that it's not tremendously better in 2025. Incidentally, Rubenhold made a great podcast called Bad Women that takes a deep dive into Jack's victims. I highly recommend it.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
There was no dearth of suspects. A lot of light was shined particularly harshly on those men in the area who were Jewish. The leather apron, a staple of two professions, was proof enough for some, given that the men plying both of those trades were, by and large, Jews. And that August, the fear and prejudice fed easily into the panic and frenzy that would only grow more frenetic in the coming days. Because now comes the double event. Louis Deimschutz, a street merchant and immigrant Jew, drove his small pony cart to a club where workmen like him gathered for drinks, games, and some political conversation. It was around 1 a.m. on Sunday, September 30th, 1888. At the club's gate, he found a woman wrapped in a tarp or cloak of some sort. She appeared to him to be drunk. He went inside the club to get some help for the woman, and that's when the club members found that her throat had been cut. Two of them went to find help. They found a constable who called for Dr. William Blackwell, who showed up at the crime scene at 1:16, per his later report. This time, the dead woman was examined by Dr. Blackwell and found to have defensive wounds on her arms and hands, indicating that likely she had struggled with her attacker. But she had not been vivisected and displayed like the other women. At 1:30 that morning, another constable had done his frequent rounds at Mitre Square. Assigned to patrol the square every quarter hour, he noticed nothing amiss. A third constable was assigned to walk one of the paths into the square. He reported no activity between 1:40 and 1:42. Yet, at 1:45, the Mitre Square constable found a woman lying in her own blood in one corner of the square. The woman's skirt was hiked up, her belly laying open, her intestines having been pulled out and strewn over her right shoulder. It took a bit of unraveling, but by late in the day of October 1st, the first woman found was identified as Elizabeth Stride. Backtracking a bit, the police found that she was a Swedish emigre who had, like the others, lived in rank poverty, and her overall physical health at 45 showed it. She was known as Long Liz by her neighbors. The idea of the second woman was relatively easier. She had been found with items that gave police enough clues to work with. A woman matching her description, who had said her name was Mary Ann Kelly, had been thrown into the local drunk tank a week earlier. In her purse was a pawn ticket made out to Ann Kelly. When that woman's common-law husband feared it might be his wife, he called to inquire. He referred to her as Catherine Kelly, or Catherine Conway, as she had once been married to a guy named Thomas Conway, and he positively ID'd her as such. Catherine Conway Kelly was known on the streets by the name she more commonly used, which was Kate Edos, as Edos was her maiden name. She was found with her throat and left carotid artery cut. Her death would have been very quick. Afterward, the killer removed her left kidney and her uterus and took them home with him. The next morning, the Central News Agency received another letter. This one read,
"I was not codding, dear old boss, when I gave you the tip. You'll hear about Saucy Jackie's work tomorrow. Double event this time. Number one squealed a bit. Couldn't finish straight off." "Not the time to get ears for police. Thanks for keeping Loslow back till I got to work again. Jack the Ripper."
It bears mentioning that hungry journalists could have easily had any and all of the information printed in these letters. All they had to do was show up to the scene of the crime and listen to whatever the cops and investigators were saying. They also could have paid off unscrupulous cops for insider info. They then could have used all that info to write up fake letters. Whether or not the letters were real, now everyone, cops, media, every sentient human in London, wanted to know if the Ripper had indeed killed two women in one night. It stood to reason that he may have killed Elizabeth first, but had been scared away before he could disembowel her. That unfulfilled desire, if you can call it that, was then heaped upon Catherine, which might also explain not only the bodily ruin, but the tortured facial slashings that her corpse suffered. That was new to Ripper victims. The two crime scenes, by the way, were only 12 minutes apart on foot. But Elizabeth was killed with a short-bladed knife, and Catherine was killed with a long-bladed knife, as had the other of the Ripper victims. Could Catherine have been the victim of a copycat killer? Or did Jack just switch knives because, you know, as a butcher or cobbler, see leather apron evidence, he might have had multiple knives at his disposal? And was the escalated violence shown to Catherine indeed the result of unfulfilled desires from the first, possibly thwarted attack that night? Or was it the natural escalation in violence often seen in serial killings? Was it a copycat killer, or did Jack change his weapon of choice mid-killing spree? Criminal profiler Douglas has this to say about the differences in the murders. Quote, "People, criminals included, do all sorts of things for no particular conscious reason, and this is difficult to factor into your analysis. From my experience, every major case seems to have loose ends. If you're a detective or a profiler, you get used to this ambiguity. You don't like it, but you learn to live with it." End quote. 2 weeks later, on October 16th, George Lusk, president of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, received a small package containing half a kidney that had been preserved in wine, and the following letter.
"Frimmel, Mr. Lusk. Sir, I send you half a kidney I took from one woman and preserved it for you. T'other piece I fried and ate. It were very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out if you only wait a while longer. Signed, catch me when you can, Mr. Lusk."
The letter was riddled with spelling errors and seems to have been written in a particular kind of London dialect, unlike the first two letters. Lusk immediately turned it over to the curator of the London Pathological Museum for examination. What's particularly strange to me about this is that the language and spelling in this letter are vastly different from the first two, but the state of the advanced Bright's disease matched the kidney that was left in Catherine's body. So the person who wrote this note had to have killed Catherine or somehow received her kidney from the person who did. Unless, as some have argued, he stole the kidney from a corpse and it just happened to have the same disease as Catherine's. There were other letters too, but their authenticity has been seriously questioned. Indeed, some 40-odd years after the murders, a journalist confessed to having written both the Dear Boss and Saucy Jackie letters in order to drum up more readers. Like the murders themselves and the half a kidney in the sheer panic that must have been spreading through the streets of London weren't enough. But Jack himself was almost done. On November 9th, 1888, a Friday, a messenger came knocking on Mary Jane Kelly's door. It was late morning, and he was there to collect the rent from the woman who lived at number 13 Miller's Court. When she didn't answer, he assumed she was dodging him, so he let himself in with the aid of a broken window. Inside, in a tiny room with not much more than the bed she lay on, was Mary Jane. The form on the bed was no longer identifiable as having once been a human. It was savagely torn apart, deboned, and ripped to shreds. Her face had been obliterated. Her heart was missing. This is what a homicidal frenzy looked like. The killer had wanted to destroy her very being and likely took 2 hours in her body's company to do it. In the hours before this took place, she had asked a friend for money, but he didn't have any to offer. Friends then saw her with a man and reported hearing a scream in the housing block at about 3:45 a.m. It would seem that no one bothered to investigate who was screaming or why, though. She was found 7 hours later. Marianne was a sex worker for the same reason they all were. She had no other means to make a living. And she drank, as did the others. Life had not been kind to her, and at just 25, she'd seen plenty. Born Mary Jeanette Kelly, the Irish lass was known as Ginger, Fair Emma, Dark Mary, or Black Mary. She was, said a pal, sick of her life in Whitechapel and wanted to go home and start over. Who could blame her? Her murder was the first that occurred indoors, leaving the Ripper plenty of time and privacy to carve her up. According to the November 19th issue of the Daily Telegraph, her much-delayed funeral was attended by only 8 people, 6 of them women who lived as she did. The inscription on her grave in Leytonstone Cemetery reads, quote, "In loving memory of Marie Jeanette Kelly, none but the lonely hearts can know my sadness. Love lives forever." End quote.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Marie Jeanette Kelly was, as far as most are concerned, Jack the Ripper's final victim. After her, it seems, he dropped off the face of the earth. And we know, of course, that serial killers don't usually just throw in the towel and stop killing. They only stop if they're caught or they die. Obviously, the former never happened, and so the mystery of who this man that terrorized the working women of Whitechapel was has grown, and the list of Ripper suspects is long and distinguished, and at times, ridiculous. I will dispense with the ridiculous ones first. Contrary to popular opinion, no one in Victorian England even brought up Queen Victoria's son, Prince Albert Victor, Duke of Clarence and Avondale. Prince Eddie, as he was known, occasionally slipped over to the other side of the tracks to frolic with the raggedy-ass masses, but he was just not that guy. Did he father a child out of wedlock? Might have. Was he syphilitic? Yes. Got that in the West Indies, apparently. Was his health, both physical and mental, precarious? Absolutely. But was he a homicidal maniac? No. He was not even on the Ripper radar, in fact, until 1962, when Philippe Julien, a French historian, art critic, and author/illustrator, mentioned it in passing in his book Edward and the Edwardians. A quick snippet. Quote, "Before he died, poor Clarence was a great anxiety to his family. He was quite characterless and would soon have fallen prey to some intrigue or group of rogues of which his regiment was full. They indulged in every form of debauchery. The young man's evil reputation soon spread. The rumor gained ground that he was Jack the Ripper. Others attributed the crimes committed in Whitechapel to the Duke of Bedford." End quote. But that's it. And while it would have made for an incredible story, most people with their heads screwed on tight don't believe it. In 1996, some dude named Richard Wallace put out a book claiming that Lewis Carroll, of Alice in Wonderland and taking inappropriate pictures of little girls in his rowboat fame, was Jack the Ripper, with his friend Thomas Vere Bain as an accomplice. The confession, Wallace claimed, was right there in Carroll's most famous book, written in anagram form. Critics have used the same anagram method to show that Carroll also killed Nicole Brown Simpson. There are at least 100 other suspects who have been volunteered by a panoply of authors, historians, and zealots throughout the last century and this. They have all been given copious amounts of ink. FBI deluxe profiler John Douglas believes that, quote, "all killers and sexual predators, in my opinion, have some degree of mental illness," end quote. I'm going to go ahead and file that under no shit, sir. And there is a legal distinction between being mentally ill enough to not know what you're doing is wrong and to know that what you're doing is wrong but not be able to control your impulses. Jack was determined to have been sane enough to know what he was doing was wrong. If he knew that he had to hide it, he knew it was wrong. Still, he could not stop. Experts who try to single out the real Jack always come back to this question. They all seem to think he would not have stopped of his own volition, especially since the attacks were progressively more deranged than the one before. So they do the reasonable thing. They look to see who was incarcerated that fall of 1888, or at those who may have been institutionalized that fall by concerned family members, or at those who might have died at his own hand. This tends to narrow the list considerably. On the other hand, depending on how you look at it, it can make for new and exciting suspects that hardly anyone has brought up before. In 1993, the alleged diaries of James Maybrick, a Liverpool cotton broker, came to light in a book entitled The Diary of Jack the Ripper. The commentary that accompanies the diary is by Shirley Harrison. Seems Maybrick was a tortured soul, depressed and angry about his wife's infidelities. In lieu of killing her, he killed other women. Tests done on the writing paper used for the diary seem genuine to the era, but the handwriting, when compared with available Maybrick script, falls woefully short. Anachronisms were found. The diary's writing appears to have been done in a few sittings rather than in daily spurts. That's a hard sell there. In 2002, best-selling author Patricia Cornwell put the name Walter Sickert out there as the definitive Jack in her nonfiction book Portrait of a Killer, Jack the Ripper, Case Closed. Sickert was an artist, and Cornwell analyzed his paintings and his early life. He had birth defects as well as genital surgeries as a child, to help shore up a vast array of forensic work on the note that the Ripper allegedly sent to the local official on old hotel registries on a friend's remembrance of him as a Jekyll and Hyde personality type. But there are relatives who say Sickert wasn't even in London that late summer and early autumn. Seems it's tough to tie up all the loose ends to make the Ripper rap work. Or you can try to go all in on the science. In 2019, a study published in the Journal of Forensic Sciences by Jari Luelinen, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, a biochemist at Liverpool's John Moores University, and David Miller, a forensic scientist, claimed to have DNA samples taken from Kate Edow's shawl. Two matches were found. One was to Kate, of course, and the other to Aaron Kosminski, as cross-referenced by a living relative. Kosminski, a perennial suspect, was a Polish barber, just 23, in 1888. Now, there are a few problems here. Notably, where did the authors of the study get the shawl, and why is it not mentioned in police reports at the time? Luelinen and Miller said at the time they couldn't be more specific of how the DNA was cross-matched because it was an issue of patient privacy. Others refute the need for privacy in this case and wonder aloud how they are supposed to judge these results without looking at the relationship of those who offered their DNA for matching and how the sequencing they used allowed them to arrive at the conclusion. It should be noted that despite the official stop date, another murder occurred a few months later that had Ripper markings. On Friday, February 13th, 1889, Frances Coles, a sex worker, was found with her throat cut but alive under a railway arch in Whitechapel. Her assault had been interrupted, police decided, which explained why she was not further mutilated. She died of her injuries before help arrived. A man named James Sadler was charged with the murder but was released because of lack of evidence and a solid alibi. I'm going back to my FBI Uber profiler guy, John Douglas. He has looked at the Ripper every which way from Sunday and comes up with a few suspects he would have liked to sit down and chat with. They mirror, in some instances, the notes written by Scotland Yard's Sir Robert Anderson on some of his case files at the time of the killings. Each is remarkable for his reason for stopping. The first, Montague Druitt, 41, a barrister from Dorset, alleged by a cop who seemed to have some misinformation in general to be sexually insane. I could find absolutely nothing to substantiate this claim or even illuminate me as to what exactly sexually insane even means. I would wager a guess that anyone who admitted to liking anything other than straight missionary-style sex back then was deemed to be sexually insane. Druitt threw himself into the Thames and was found floating on December 31st, 1888, after having spent a month in the water. Yuck. The next is the aforementioned Aaron Kosminski, a Whitechapel hairdresser who ate garbage as he feared the food given to him by others, which is a level of bizarre I can't even begin to touch on. Kosminski was institutionalized in a mental asylum in 1890 and remained there the rest of his life. Lastly, there's 23-year-old David Cohen, aka Nathan Kosminski, a man who was clearly disturbed and a mentally disorganized mess, unable to take care of himself. According to the casebook, Jack the Ripper website, Cohen was violently antisocial and virulently anti-woman. He became sick in December of 1888 and died the following October. Seems to this armchair detective that those two are the most likely culprits. And so, stranger, after nearly a century and a half, it seems we are no closer to solving this mystery. At the end of the day, it no longer really matters who Jack the Ripper was. Even if someone could figure it out and dissect his life, what would be the point? By now, thanks to the work of profilers like John Douglas, we have a pretty good idea of what drives these men, for they are almost always men, to do what they do. Though, I suppose to be fair, we don't even know that Jack the Ripper was a man. Maybe Jack was short for Jacqueline. I suppose it's a small consolation that in the years since Jack's victims met their end at his hand, some dogged historians have put in the work to find out more about who they were. They likely will never get justice in the form of putting an identity to their killer, if that can even be called justice. The least we can do is honor the lives they lived. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, the folks who boarded the ill-fated Titanic had no way of knowing that thousands of them would perish in the North Atlantic when the unsinkable ship hit an iceberg and sank. One wonders, though, if some of them, as the ship went down, were suddenly reminded of a short story they'd read nearly 15 years earlier that seemingly foretold their fate. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written and researched by Amy Wilson and me, Daisy Egan. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.